The film 1917 is up for an Academy Award at the ceremony on Sunday. It's the story of two young British lance corporals in World War I who have to deliver a message through enemy lines. They have to get word to a battalion of 1,600 soldiers that they're being lured into an ambush, an almost certain massacre. The musical score for 1917 has also been nominated for an Oscar, and the radio host Edmund Stone recently pointed out for us a segment in the score where the intensity of the almost relentless motion in the film breaks, and there's this moment of joy, or a moment of light.
I think everybody who hears our voices probably knows somebody who has served on a battlefield. And they can probably relate to the intense emotional drain and struggle in a difficult situation like a war would be. There is a moment, for instance, in 1917 called the Night Window. The soldier has managed to get up to a church where there's a sniper. He takes out the sniper, but in the ricochet, it blows him back down the stairs of the steeple. And knocks him unconscious. Fades to black. And then he starts to wake up after being concussed. And he looks up, and the door that he just blew through, he sees the door closed, but framed entirely in a bright light. Is he imagining this? Has he passed on? What's going on here? And you realize that what he's doing is slowly coming back to the now, realizing he has not finished his mission, he's got to keep on going. Why is that light there? It's a very short cue, and it's a gorgeous piece of music. It has this building growth of strings, which just reaches into your soul and soothes you and makes you feel wonderful, even though you're watching a very dark scene in a very dark film. For 1 minute or two, this man now knows light again.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Edmund Stone says most of us don't really think about the music in a movie until it's not there. In fact, he says, if you do notice the music, it's probably not working. But paying attention to movie scores is what Stone does for a living. He hosts a radio program called The Score. And so we thought we'd ask him to join us and take us through the five scores up for an Oscar on Sunday. There's the music from 1917, from Joker, the latest Star Wars, from Little Women, and Marriage Story. Edmund Stone joined us from the studios of All Classical Portland in Portland, Oregon. So let's talk about Joker. This is directed by Todd Phillips, and it's another one of those sort of Joker Genesis stories in the Batman series. This is the story of Arthur Fleck, a mentally troubled young man, has ambitions of being a comedian, but of course, his life transforms into something quite dark, the Joker itself. Talk a little bit about the incredibly dark and surreal themes that are at play here emotionally and how the music now needs to step up to illustrate this.
I think it would be very hard for any composer to begin to write music for this dark story. Because you can't write music for the story, because the story itself is so dark and so familiar to some people, because it comes from Gotham City, of course, and it's Joker. We know where that is going. So you have to get inside the character. And really and truly, although there's some wonderful acting in Joker, as I think you'll probably agree with me, Doug, there's only one person in Joker, and he's so intensely played and so incredibly played by Joaquin Phoenix. that how do you get into this man's mind, into this performance mind, this mindset, and make it work? Well, Hildur Gudnadóttir, who's a first-time Oscar nominee from Iceland, studied with Johan Johansson. And she is doing so well on the award-winning circuit right now because this music really does get inside the psyche without actually disrupting it. If you didn't do what Hilda's done, the music would be separate to the performance. And it must not do that. It must not take away from what you're seeing and feeling. It must be part of that. How did she do it? Well, if you listen to what she said that some scenes in Joker inspired on-set performances because she started to write some of the themes on cello when she first got the script. Before she even saw a frame, she got the idea of what this music should say. And because her first instrument is cello, she sent some tapes off to, or some recordings off to the director with that cello theme. They liked it and told her to continue with her ideas and liked it so much they started to play some of the music on the set to inspire the actors who are performing. For instance, there is situations where they respond to the music in rehearsal, and there are situations where the director allowed the music to lead what the actors should be doing. In other words, music is in some cases, according to Hilda, directing what you're about to see in that scene. That is the symbiosity of having a good score attached to a good performance.
Let's take the piece Subway. This is the first time in the film when the cello is principally used. It's when the maybe set this up for us, if you would, Edmund. The Joker, the Joaquin Phoenix character, Arthur, has been taunted and humiliated.
Yes, he's on a subway train. It's late at night. There aren't many people in the carriage. There are three men, and he doesn't like them at all because they're rich and wealthy and they're putting themselves around as being in control of everything. Whereas he is a very poor person trying to struggle, he's doing a part-time job which is failing as a clown on the street. Yeah. Also in this carriage is a lady sitting across from these three well-dressed men. And they start tormenting her. These three men start tormenting this lady in the carriage for no reason at all, but because they can. And he doesn't like it, but he's too shy to say anything. Now, what we should say to set this up is the character in Joker, the Arthur Fleck character, has not just a psychological problem. He has an issue of laughing. He has occasional moments when he can't stop laughing, and he bursts out laughing for no reason at all. But when those men who are taunting that lady see and hear him laughing, they think he's laughing at them. So they come after him, and they really hurt him. They knock him down, and they kick him. But what they don't know is that early in the day he'd been given a gun by a co-worker. And this is the first time he uses that gun. He takes out the gun and he takes care of the situation in a rather nasty way. And that's the beginning of Arthur Fleck becoming not just the person who's ill, but the person who realizes he has a voice now. He can actually take center stage and be known for who he is, not just a victim constantly. And he does that. And so what you're going to hear now is the first major use of Hilda Gudnadóttir's cello as the Joker is taunted and then exacts revenge. You're hearing Dissonance. You're hearing a minor key a lot more than you normally would hear. And it's really just a theme that is going to tell you this is never going to end well.
there's this odd musical irony at play, it seems, where you have this violence and this troubling moment, and then the idea when he dances as well. The contrast between ugliness and beauty seems to be another thing that's at play in these, in the music in this film.
I'm glad you brought up the dancing, Doug. This is a very important aspect of Joker, is that Joker, as well as producing laughter for no apparent reason, and not always pleasant laughter, by the way, he can also dance. He learns is the wrong word. He just is able to gracefully dance. He dances everywhere. He dances on the platform after he's attacked the men.
Mm-hmm.
He dances on a set of steps going down the city just because he can.
Mm-hmm.
But think about this. What kind of dance would a maniacal person with tremendous problems psychologically do? He doesn't do what you think he's going to do. Joaquin Phoenix does not do what you think he's going to do. You might think he'd do a staccato move, perhaps a punching move in his dance steps, more of a vigorous one. No. He's graceful. It's almost like watching a ballet. He allows the music to move his arms and his legs, and he's totally solo in those dances. He doesn't dance with anybody else. He's just in the moment of dance. And Hilda has a lot to do with that, the composer, Hilda Gorinada, because she created the dance. She created the music for the dance that, in some cases, would actually inspire Joaquin Phoenix and the director to go with it. And it works.
You've said that this music just seems right to you.
Joker is a dark film. Not a film, I imagine, that a lot of people will want to see again and again and again. This is not Star Wars. This is a film that strikes a momentary chord emotionally and with great sadness and darkness. I don't think Joker will stand up as a score in 2 or 3 years' time.
Mm.
It's not an easy score to listen to after the movie. And I'm all about, as you know, on the score. I'm always about reconnecting our listeners with the movie they saw a year ago, 50 years ago.
Yeah.
I don't think you'll be able to do that very often with Joker. It will work now just as the Nine Inch Nails gentleman did with The Social Network. We don't hear The Social Network music very often, and yet it won the Academy Award for Best Score.
Hmm.
It will be extremely unfair to say that this is a one-off. But it's the right score at the right time for the right film, and that's very often what wins awards.
It's Edmund Stone. He's the host of the public radio program The Score, from All Classical Portland in Portland, Oregon. The Academy Awards are Sunday night. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
If you want public radio listeners to learn more about your business or organization, consider becoming a KUER sponsor. You can support informative, engaging programming through a variety of opportunities on our radio, digital, and events platforms. We're proud to partner with the community to bring trustworthy journalism to Utah. To learn more about becoming a sponsor, look for the support tab at KUER.org and click on Business Support.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the radio host Edmund Stone is with us. He's taking us through the film scores nominated for an Oscar this year. The ceremony is on Sunday. Stone hosts a radio program called The Score. Let's shift gears, talk about Star Wars, The Rise of Skywalker. This is, of course, the ninth and final part of the original Star Wars series, directed again by J.J. Abrams. And we probably don't have to say too much about what this one is about. Let's talk about John Williams, the composer. I guess he is, fair to say, Edmund Stone, the senior figure among movie composers these days?
Yes. Yeah, that would be correct to say that. I mean, if you could say, did any one person make symphonic film music current and popular, it would have to be John Williams. Mm. You can't get away from the fact that this man was writing music with Henry Mancini back in the 60s as Johnny Williams. He was playing piano on Henry Mancini LPs. You know, and he has won 5 Academy Awards and been nominated, as of this time, 51 times. I mean, I don't know even if you have a house in Hollywood that can hold the certificate of 51 nominations, let alone the 5 Academy Awards. But no, he is turning 88 tomorrow, Saturday, and then the next day, or coming up on Saturday, and the next day on Sunday is the Academy Awards, where he will be. Who knows?
Yeah.
Is there a sentimental favorite? You could say that. I mean, when I heard that John Williams was making the 9th Star Wars a couple of years ago, and I said to my colleagues, you know, he could just win the award just for the very fact that he'd been there for 42 glorious years and gave us all this music. And he hasn't actually won an Academy Award for nearly 20 years.
Yeah.
He's been nominated many, many times, but he hasn't won. And so this could be John Williams' year if it's a sentimental favorite. But to think in terms of what John Williams has done at the point of the mid-70s, symphonic music in the movies had just about disappeared. I mean, even the great Jerry Goldsmith recognized this when he did Planet of the Apes as an atonal score. He knew it was moving. John Williams sort of just said, no, I think we can still keep symphonic orchestral music on a score if the studios can afford to pay for an orchestra. So thinking back to Jaws and then much more with Star Wars and Close Encounters and then E.T., and everyone started to come back to the symphonic repertoire in film music, and that's 40 years ago, and it's still with us. So if nothing else, and that nothing else is a big nothing else, we have a great debt, as a spoonerism, to thank John Williams for what he has done to keep film music alive, both behind the cameras and also in concert halls.
Mm. So there are two pieces, selections from this latest Star Wars I wanted to ask you about. I wanted to start with Reunion, because I guess, aside from the way the music illustrates, the dramatic moments and the action, the distinctive thing about this music, it seems, is how, to me anyway, is how each of the main characters has a theme. And that these themes are, I have to say, deeply embedded in the bloodstream of popular culture at this point. You know, the Princess Leia's theme, Luke's theme, we all sort of know them. And Darth Vader's theme, I can't think of maybe a movie theme that's more identifiable aside from Jaws than the Darth Vader theme.
We have to say that John Williams did not invent that. That was invented, most people acknowledge, by Richard Wagner in the second half of the 19th century with his leitmotifs for his operas.
Yeah.
You know, you had the Ring theme, and you had the main themes that went through the operas, the Germanic operas of the 1860s and 1870s. And Wolfgang Korngold picked up on that with his Warner Brothers days, think in terms of Robin Hood. You know, you have Robin Hood's theme and you have Maid Marian's theme. And Williams learned around, was starting to come into music around the time that Korngold was about to pass the baton to others. So yes, when you have a motif like Princess Leia theme, or you have a Yoda theme, what are you doing? Musically, you're telling the audience, whether that character is there at that moment on screen or about to appear, here comes Princess Leia. Here comes Luke Skywalker. Here comes Darth Vader himself. And we are ready for it. The Jaws 2-note theme. Da, da. That's a motif.
Yeah.
It still tells you what you are expecting now to see and hear. So when Williams is doing the reunion, we're going to hear several things. For instance, we're going to hear the trio, which is the music he composed originally for Ray and Finn and Poe, and then the wonderful Yoda, mischievous Yoda theme. What that means, because you're seeing similar characters on the screen, or in some cases the same one, what that means is you've got a two-hour movie, and if half of your movie, hypothetically, is old themes brought back, that doesn't give you much room for new stuff.
Right. Sounds very John Williams-y, doesn't it? All this brass.
Yep. Here's the trio. This is Ray and Finn and Poe. There's the Star Wars theme. This is the Rebellion.
So we're cycling back, aren't we? We were returning to the beginning.
We can't really help ourselves, really. I mean, on the one hand, I'm so happy. I'm happy that John Williams is still with us at 88, almost 88 years of age. Yeah. I'm so happy of what he's done. I wouldn't be doing my job today, I think, Doug, if it hadn't been for John Williams and Jerry Goldsmith and that cadre of wonderful, talented people who gave us something to listen to 20 years later.
Okay, there's another moment from Star Wars. And this is a moment that is not so familiar, I think, for most of us. It's a moment where Kylo Ren is the young, conflicted commander of the First Order. Bad guys, the film begins anyway. He's trying to convince Rey, she's the protagonist, the main character. I'm sure you probably most know that. He's trying to convince her to come with him to the dark side. And this is a section called Join Me. Take us through this moment, too, because you've talked about how it's fairly low-key for such a really critical moment in the film.
I kind of have a little personal issue with this, and I guess it's because I expected there is a major scene that follows this, and I won't spoil it for those who haven't seen it, where you are having a major conflict. The biggest conflict potentially in the entire series is coming up. But before that, we have Join Me. And yes, he is the proverbial guy in black. And he wants Rey, with her powers, to come on over to the dark side. You know, we've seen this before. It happened in The Empire Strikes Back with Darth Vader and Luke, remember? When he told him he was his father. But he thinks they can rule together. And Rey won't have anything to do with this. And so it's going to come down to a fist fight, as we would call it now, but back in those days it was a lightsaber. I just found that the fact that the scene was fairly low-key was either a good thing or a not-so-good thing. It's a good thing if you're saying, I don't want this music to get in the way of this major struggle that's about to take place. So again, Williams saying, I'm not going to give you what you think you need here. I'm going to tell you what I think you should have here. And you may say, that's a good thing, that's a bad thing. It's, to me, I wanted more drama in this music because it means a lot. After this scene, everything changes. Everything you've ever known about Star Wars will change after this scene is over. And I think I wanted more satisfaction from the music, but I'm only me. Others may disagree.
There's that subtlety there, I guess.
Yes, it's almost the question. Come on over. No, thanks, I'm fine where I am, isn't it? And yet you have to understand, this is a moment when one side will be left standing. You know, there's a moment in 1917 when the commanding officer played in the trenches by Benedict Cumberbatch responds to the decision to call off the attack by saying, you know how wars end? Wars end with one man left standing. And this is this moment here. One person, it could be him, it could be her, but only one can remain standing. Who's it going to be?
So, Edmund, we both feel a sense of nostalgia for this, but is there anything original about this score? Anything worthy, certainly for a nomination, but is it worthy of another win?
Oh, that's such a loaded, powerful question. Thank you for that one, Doug. Because, yeah, the answer is yes and no. The answer is yes, because of what it is and what it stands for. And from the point of view of putting your check on a ballot of five nominees, if you're a voting member, and saying, yes, this is my choice, sentimentality. But if you're asking me, when you stack this score up against the other four nominations, which I think is what you're asking me, then I have to say I doubt it. I mean, if John Williams gets it, even if he gets it because they love the music, they're still going to say after the fact, but he got it because it's John Williams and Star Wars.
Let's shift to Little Women, directed by Greta Gerwig, of course. This is a story from, well, of course, Louisa May Alcott. It's been done many times before, six times before. This is the seventh version of it. So let's talk about the music, Alexandre Desplat. What did you think, generally? I mean, you like his work, but I gather you weren't exactly bowled over by this particular score.
Well, in my show, I say that, yes, I'm a big fan of Alexandre Desplat. He's been on my show a number of times. He's a good friend of the score and a good friend of film music in getting the word out. And I think he's a tireless, tireless worker. He regularly does anywhere between five and seven scores a year, which is a phenomenal output of great music, most of it great music. But I have to say, when I'm listening to Little Women, I just felt it could have been better. There are some of the piano lines that Alexander likes to use in Little Women, I heard similarities to some of his earlier themes. A film that comes to mind immediately is Philomena, which is a tremendous film, which starred Judi Dench, and he was nominated for that film too. But it's almost impossible. Let's talk about John Williams again. It's almost impossible not to hear elements of an earlier score by that person. I mean, creativity, when you're under pressure, you know, it's hard. So there's probably only one composer living today who has done so much creativity on different projects without hardly any of it sounding alike, and that's Ennio Morricone. He's up there as my number one, because he can produce a score that doesn't sound like anything else he's done. How he does it, I don't know. That's what every composer and every artist strives for. You want to push the boundaries a little bit. I don't think Alexandra is necessarily pushing boundaries on this score.
So I wanted to let's talk about a cue or a section from Little Women called Dance on the Porch. And I wanted to know, how do composers handle period films? Because this one is set in the 19th century. So it seems like you have to create an element of that time. Or do you? Or do you go in a very different direction? And how does Desplat do? What does Desplat do in this particular score?
Well, he doesn't. He does not take what the scene begins with, which is a nice, comfortable, rather upper-class ballroom setting of a chamber ensemble playing music of the mid-19th century to well-dressed, somewhat affluent people dancing in this nice big house. He doesn't even try to go there. He takes this couple who are now on the porch. The lady cannot dance, or she's been told she mustn't dance because she's accidentally singed her dress. And if she dances, people will notice that her dress is damaged. So she walks outside with a gentleman, and they decide to just do an improvised jig. Now, if there's one piece of music in all of Little Women that is highly original, I would say it's this jig that it's called Dance on the Porch. And Laurie and Joe are on the porch of an elegant house, as we said, and they improvise this jig outside on the porch. And what's interesting is I would like to see the various takes of this scene, because to all intents and purposes, you're looking at this couple dancing away on a jig completely free, without any restraints from 19th century decorum, which is what's very heavily loaded into Little Women, as you know, as a story. But they are just doing their thing. They're improvising and having a great time, sometimes alone, sometimes together, sometimes touching, sometimes not, but they're just having a great time. That would have been a great outtake to see that in the extra speeches. But Alexander has, and I'm not sure what the answer is on this one, either he created the score to that scene beforehand, or he matched it afterwards. But the jig, it's how does one, you know, a jig is such a unique piece of music to a unique dance. Mm-hmm. You don't expect to see it in polite 19th century society. It's great. So we have a sort of almost an introduction to the couple. And they're sort of squaring around, eyeing each other up. This is not that different from what the older people are doing in the house. Then somebody starts to dance, and the other person starts to dance at the same time. And now, listen to what we're hearing. 1, 2, 3. 1, 2, 3. 1, 2, 3. The beat is on. 1, 2, 3. 1, 2, 3. It's a step. And Alexander captures it perfectly.
You've said you hear something a little quirky in here, too.
I do. And you know something, Doug? I am hearing this again, and I'm exhausted. If I had to do what that couple had to do constantly, I'd be out of breath in no time at all.
What about the piece, It's Romance, from Little Women?
It's Romance is a scene in Little Women, and Little Women as a film, I think, has some issues because you're going to be appealing to several generations of moviegoers who know this book very well, who have known this book since they were children, who read it to their own children and their own grandchildren. So it's you can't mess around very much. It would be like improvising Shakespeare. You can't do that.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, I don't know what Greta's intention was to do the transition of chronology. She goes 7 years back, 7 years forward. Now that's not a bad movie option, except it's not in the book, and we get a little bit turned off by that because this isn't how Louisa Alcott wrote the story. For obvious reasons, she wasn't doing visually, she was doing it as a book. The other thing I found problem with that is 7 years is not a major difference to a person's look. And so going back and forward in those 7 year time frames, I had a personal problem seeing if that character was that character 7 years ago or 7 years into the future, because they hadn't changed that much. So that was one aspect of it. The other aspect of it, I think, was that Louisa Alcott's book is very, very, very strong in defining the boundaries of the wealth of the family. And there isn't any wealth. They're very poor people. Mm. And yet when they go, when they take their Christmas morning food to a nearby house of a mother and her children who has no food on Christmas Day, and they give them their food, you see that the couple receiving the food are better dressed than anybody else. And you think, well, how can that be if they're so poor and they can't even afford food for their children on Christmas morning? Mm-hmm. So there are little elements visually and in the style of this story that didn't completely sit well with me. And also, in the piece called Romance, which ends the film, there is a little bit of a confusion because it is the happy ending of Little Women. Everyone is together that is still remaining alive, and they've got their partners and they've got their children, and they're having a wonderful family gathering in the new school they've built after the aunt gave them gave the lady her house, and she decided to turn it into a school and educate other people. And there's this very happy, contented romance feeling at the end of the film. But at the same time, because the publisher of the book that she takes to be published about her life story, which becomes Little Women, because he says we must have happy endings, We don't want anybody who's not married and unhappy. They've got to have a happy ending. So she creates this happy ending in the movie. But we don't know if it's the real happy ending.
Right.
Or if it's an extension of the dream that she had to create a happy ending to finish the book and get it published. A little bit confusing.
That's from Alexander Desplat's score for the film Little Women, which is nominated for an Academy Award this year. The ceremony is on Sunday. We're talking to Edmund Stone. He's the host of the radio program The Score on All Classical Portland in Portland, Oregon. We'll take another break and be back in a moment. This is Radio West.
If you recently bought a new car, and now you're wondering what to do with the other one that's been hibernating in your garage all winter, consider donating it to KUER. We'll handle all the towing, and you could receive a tax deduction. Whether it's running or not, your old vehicle can help fuel the programs you rely on, like Morning Edition, Wait Wait Don't Tell Me, and Radio West. To get started, visit KUER.org/vehicle.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, a diversion for those of you tired of a week of political turmoil. We're talking about the movies today. Actually, the original film score is nominated for an Academy Award. The ceremony is on Sunday. And there are five films in the category: 1917, Joker, Star Wars, Little Women. And now, on to the music from Marriage Story. Final film. Marriage Story, directed and written by Noah Baumbach. This is a sort of granular look at the breakdown of a marriage between an actress and a theater director. Caught in the middle, of course, is their 8-year-old son. And really, one of the things you've mentioned, Edmund, is it's nothing terribly fancy as the visuals go. It's mostly, I guess, about the performances.
I thought Marriage Story is a very powerful, strong film. Not just because of the performances, which have been nominated all over the place. They are excellent performances. And there's only really three people in this film. Mm-hmm. The father, the mother, and the child, as you said. One of the things that I found powerful about Marriage Story was, I'll bet you a lot of people who see this film are relating to it. Perhaps, hopefully, not directly. But they know somebody who's gone through a similar situation. And therefore, it has a ring of truth about it. We have a marriage going, breaking up. And at little tiny flickers on the screen, you think, maybe they'll make up now. Maybe they can just stop this nonsense and make this work again. And you know it's not going to happen. And the more times that happens, and it could just be a look that Scarlett Johansson gives to Adam, or a look back, or a comment, or something like that. And it's, there is still love there. Not just love because they have a child together, but there's still affection. The last, I won't spoil it, but if you've seen the film, Doug, you'll know what I'm talking about. The very last scene in this film, you know it's probably over, but not quite. They'll never be enemies. The lawyers in this film are portrayed as the people that want to end this marriage because that's their job. They're hired to do that in the best way they can. We're not on the lawyer's side here. We are on the couple and the child's side. We know that they're going to have to live in separate towns, and we know what that can possibly do to bringing up a child. So, you know, if nothing else, Marriage Story has a tremendous ring of plausibility about it. It's a real story. Joker isn't a real story. Mm-hmm. Star Wars isn't a real story. But Marriage Story could be a real story.
And Randy Newman has been chosen to score this film. Let's talk about a few moments, because I want to talk about a particular cue, a particular section called What I Like About Nicole. The title to that particular section comes from a list, and maybe you could set this up for us. You say it's a moment when they sort of put aside the difficulty and the bitterness. And it's another, not hearkening back to the Star Wars idea of nostalgia, but this is a return maybe for this particular story to better times, I guess.
They've been kind of, we think they've been sort of charged by their counselors and their friends to write down, you know, you're going into this horrible thing, separating from the person you've loved for so many years and have a child with. But what do you think positively about each other? And the film starts that way and almost ends that way. Nicole, played by Scarlett Johansson, she has to write What I Like About Charlie, her husband, played by Adam Driver. Mm-hmm. And so she's going to say the good things and the occasional irritating things that their partner has that they can't quite like, and something that they do quite like. And each one of the two of them, Charlie then has to write his story, his lines, about What I Like About Nicole. And you realize that really the likes outweigh the dislikes. So why are they going through this? It has to be more than just the notes on the page. Mm. And by that, I mean the lines of description on the page. And what I like about Charlie and what I like about Nicole are considered the co-main themes by Randy Newman. There isn't a lot of music in this film. Randy Newman only has 25 and a half minutes of music on the soundtrack. Compare that to John Williams or any major blockbuster movie these days, which has between 70 and 74 minutes. Oh. So you'll see that Randy Newman has chosen economy here because he doesn't want to get in the way of what's actually going on the screen. The wrong note, the wrong phrasing can completely disrupt these scenes because they're very intense. There's a scene, for instance, in My Story, where they lose it and they start to say hurtful things to each other. And I think we've lived on this earth long enough to know that that's quite possible going to happen. And you say things and they come out of your mouth and you wish you hadn't said that. You may have thought it, but you shouldn't have said it. And that's in this scene. And then suddenly there's this emptiness, almost like as they look at each other, they're saying, I didn't mean to say it like that. And I think this is What I Like About Nicole, What I Like About Charlie. This keeps coming back. And I think it's probably because Randy Newman, he's not doing much music here. And it's not a lot of music in and of itself. It's mostly piano with chamber orchestra and oboe, which could also be chamber orchestra. There's not a lot of orchestral music going on in this score. Think about Randy's other music to the Pixar films, to Toy Story. You've got a lot of melodies going on there, but not in Marriage Story. It's almost like he's playing, he's composing with one arm behind his back. He wants to go into it, but he knows that if he does, it'll be too late and he can't pull back.
So, Edmund, take us through What I Like About Charlie, because this piece is mostly piano, and I guess it's Randy Newman probably playing, right? I would assume
it is. Yeah.
Yeah. So one of the things that you've talked about is that you've got these themes, right? And which I think is perfect to illustrate themes is you have wife and husband, and they're together and. Maybe am I hearing in some ways the blending at first and then the breaking apart, establishing their own sort of separate identity?
That's exactly what you're hearing. And also, let's be honest about this. Randy Newman is not, he does not want to make a major impression or a minor one, if we're using the note phrasing. He wants that music to guide you as they're looking at the list and as they're reading the list. And there's a little scene towards the end of the film where Adam Driver, as the father, they've now gone through the divorce, and it's going to end the way it's inevitable, unfortunately. And he's trying to help his son read. So the boy has picked up this list, What I Like About Nicole, and he's starting to read the list. He's having a bit of a hard time struggling with some of the words on that page. And so his father, who's helping him read, steps in and starts to read with his son, reading out loud what the film started with, which is this list called What I Like About Nicole. At that moment, because it's the ending really of the movie, Scarlett Johansson as Nicole is in the background just looking. And the eyes say it all. There's still love. They've still got something together. And what he has said about her, she just finds heartbreaking because it's over now. But he still feels those things just as she did. And it's captured with the boy reading those words, not quite understanding she is really good in conversation or whatever the line might be, because he can't say the word conversation because he's only 8. And yet you're seeing this whole thing come together to the child. This 8-year-old is the one who's going to either take the brunt of this breakup or he's going to survive it. This is a setup. We're using woodwind and piano. Little harp. This could be in any Disney movie from the 80s and 90s. This is soft. This is playful. This is holding hands in the park when she's pregnant and they're going to have their child together. These are the things that he likes about her because he's a theatre director. He's used to being disciplined and being careful about what he says to his cast to get the best performance out of them. She is used to being an actress. She was a former actress, as a child actress. She's now re-emerging again as an adult actress in conventional films, playing adult roles rather than child roles. And now she's the feminine. She's the feminine to his masculine, and yet they've got something together, and it's this child. Interesting enough, if this was Joker, he'd be dancing to this.
You know what's interesting, too, is, and this seems such a gift of Randy Newman, is that kind of ironic contrast. You hear something kind of cinematic, as you said, sort of Disney-esque about it, yet it's playing out in a very modern film with very modern adult themes, and it seems to work so well.
But you're right about the two main themes starting almost identically and then separating, because that's what I had written down on my words for the score program. Taking on separate identities as the two main characters are in fact separating. So it's almost like we're starting with the same roux in the kitchen, but then we've separated into two different basins, and now we're having two different flavors. But it starts off with the same.
Edmund Stone, let me ask you finally. So I won't ask you to predict who will win or your favorites. I will sort of leave it to people who see these films to make their own sort of decisions. I wanted to ask you, I guess, finally, when does a composer really succeed in their work? Do you notice it? Or do you not notice it? When have they accomplished what they were really after?
I think there are two answers to that question, too. I asked composers, like, let me give you an example. I asked Alexandre Desplat once, when you see a film with your score, when you're driving home from the screening, are you saying, oh, I should have put oboes there rather than French horns? And he says, no, I'm not. I'm on the podium with the London Symphony about to start the next one. I don't give myself that luxury of looking back on my scores and critiquing them. So you could say that Alexandre Desplat delivers a score that he's completely content with. He's done his job. He's happy with it. But if you're saying, is a score ever complete? Yes, it has to be complete, because I've spoken to composers who are working on a score literally up until about 2 days before the screening, the first full screening, and they literally say, I wish I had more time, there isn't enough time, it'll have to be okay, and just hope it works. So if the question was, is the score ever complete? That would be depend upon who you ask. Every piece of work that we do, Doug, even this radio show, is the very best it can be when it airs. Does that mean it could be any better? I mean, there's an old saying that Woody Allen says he never watches any of his old movies because he always sees two more weeks of editing. So I think you can say that that score is good for that film at that time. Now, you could get somebody else coming in and rescoring a film, and they would have a completely different score as they see it. Does that make that score different to the first one? No, it just makes it different.
Edmund Stone, thank you so much. This has been fun.
Doug, it's been a great thrill to be on your program. Thank you for inviting me.
Edmund Stone. He's the host of the public radio program The Score from All Classical Portland in Portland, Oregon. The Academy Awards are Sunday night. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. As always, we'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter, at Radio West. Our intern is Natu Twe. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard, Ali Vallarta, and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.